close to getting her PhD. We have Katie Mae Lauman next to her. Katie Mae just earned her PhD the last several months. She's also from BIMS. Who's next? Alex, are you next? Alice Appenball, who hails to us, along with Ryan Jorley from some Florida connection. They both work down in Florida on fisheries projects down there. So that's our gang. And what I'm trying to tell you is something that you may not know. We added three positions to our agency for the first time since 1991 in fisheries management. Now, we do have the mandatory reporting, but as you know, mandatory reporting does just that. I mean, they're working on mandatory reporting all the time. So as far as our planners, fishery management planners, those are all new fishery management planners. Alex is more of a data guru, and Ryan has specialties in a lot of areas, but recreational statistics and fisheries is one of them. So it's unbelievable in this day and age how hard it is to get employees in the agency, but it's really hard to get employees in the agency. And Commissioner Bull was able to, last session, was able to carry that through. So we're very excited because we've been down in forces for a long time. We don't have a quorum, and I'll tell you about the assessment in a little bit, just to tell you we don't have a quorum, so we can't approve the minutes. That's number one. The introductions you've had of staff, and of course, if anyone else wants to add anything, that's good. But back to this stock assessment, it was about $540,000, and we just didn't have money. Maryland didn't have money. No one seemed to have money to do a stock assessment update. What you have to appreciate is the last time that data were active was 2009 in that stock assessment. So management, since 2011, has been operating off the trend that has happened through 2009. What we have done on our own is we've met with Maryland and the Potomac River Fisheries Commission, and we will be doing our own assessment or pieces of that that will put that together. They've got some sharp people in Maryland. They've got some sharp people in Virginia. And I think if we put everyone together, we're going to do just fine. So next meeting, when we have more folks, we can give you an update of where the problem areas are and, you know, why it's good to have a new approach to the data and everything else involved. The winter dredge survey is a big component of that stock assessment. So we do want to at least provide you some updates here. Even though the numbers are few, we're going to go through the blue crab harvest update through 2016. You probably realize that 2016 is not quite finished data-wise. Even though it's finished as far as the year goes, we still get data that trickles in, and so I don't know who's going to show that. Joe?
Yep. Okay, so this is a busy table that has the last few years. In 2016, this is just our hard pot harvest. Right now, we're standing at $26.5 million, certainly better than the last few years. 2016 is a lot more reminiscent of 2010, 2011, which you'll see later, and those seem to be pretty good years. So we did have an open season in December, so you see some December harvest there. 58 individuals reported harvest in December. And then we also track some other numbers nowadays. So number of people that we know grabbed their licenses to crab this year but still haven't reported any – whether or not they did something or had no activity. We've got 145 people that still haven't reported for December. We've got 86 people who still haven't reported in November and 49 in October. So that's where we're thinking we may see a few more reports come in. So that 2.5 million in November, am I following that right? No, sorry, the 1.4 million in November and the 2.5 million in October may go up a little bit. I don't know if, you know, I don't think we're expecting on the terms of another 500,000 pounds to put us up in the 27 million pound range just for hard pots, but should go up a little bit. And then we have the folks that did tell us that they didn't have any activity, so they haven't crabbed. So that kind of gives us a picture of activity throughout the year in the crabbing world, right, for hardpots. So you've got last March, 477 people that picked up their crab licenses or had crab licenses, but didn't go crabbing in March, as opposed to those summer months where it drops down under 300. But I mean, consistently, you've got about 300 people that are eligible to crab in the hardpot fishery and aren't doing anything. And, you know, we've showed you guys those numbers throughout the years, and it's really been consistent since about 2000, after the buyback and all that. So, you know, we've been pretty consistent since 2009-10, from 10 right through 20. And expect to see
before
that.
You fly off of that screen, I think it goes back to 2003. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember looking at 2003 forward, and that trend is still there.
Yeah, right. So it just kind of shifted down as we moved people out of the fishery in 2008.
And why it's a big issue, and Joe's looked into this, as have the other jurisdictions, or at least Maryland DNR, is there's always been this big concern that there's a pool of inactive harvesters who are just waiting for the right moment and the right abundance of crabs to move in. And some certainly do, but, you know, others aren't crabbing. So, I mean, it doesn't change that much. The big concern that we've had all these years, not just in Virginia, but other jurisdictions about latent effort, doesn't seem to pan out. I think that's what you found.
Yeah, and that's really where CDSAC is kind of weighing in on this. So, again, the jurisdiction, people from the jurisdictions that Rob mentioned, we don't feel, and it's part capacity too, right? We don't feel like the market would be able to handle a bunch more people jumping in when crabbing is good. So we don't really see it.
Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, do you know anything about the transfers of licenses? Are we hitting that cap each year?
We did last year.
Yeah, so we have the last two at least.
The last 2 years. So some people, do you know how many inactive people actually had transferred their licenses by any chance?
No, that's a good question. I don't know offhand, but yeah,
we can find out.
Start to track.
Are we seeing a trend of maybe those people transferring those licenses and then, you know, we're becoming more active?
Yeah, we can find that out.
Yeah.
That's good. Okay. Anybody else? Okay.
And can I get a copy of that?
I don't know if you want to wait. I mean,
yeah, you're going to go back. You're going to go back over this probably next meeting anyway, right?
Yeah.
Could you?
I mean, we'll get closer to final for 2016, you know, next time around. So.
Okay. I have a question for you, too, though. So 145 and 86 in November and December, they have not reported.
Mm-hmm.
I know mandatory reporting will get them to report one way or the other, but do we have any feel based on previous couple of years, how many end up just saying zero, that they didn't harvest and they just didn't bother to tell us by the time we get that information?
If you just look at the number of active in the most recent years, you can see that in 14 and 15 it was pretty consistent. And if this was if 2016 was a good fall, and of course, you know, the folks up there could answer that better than I. You know, I would say you would expect that 376 to get closer to the 450.
Yeah, okay, that's good. I think what else would be good is, you know, the trip data up there is number of individual trips that are taken. So if you look at August, you've got 8,522 trips, it looks like. I guess what you could find out, if you're trying to maximize what was going on, you would know pounds per trip, which would be pretty easy to get. And then you could probably see, you know, typically in the summer months, everyone's going to go crabbing no matter what, pretty much. And you could see how beneficial it is compared to some of the other months.
Sure, yeah. I mean, if you look at, like, 2013, where we only ended up with, and 2014, where we were closer to just 17 million pounds, you could see that we were much more successful. Because the number of trips isn't that much higher in those summer months in July and August. But we were talking about 3.7 million pounds for 8,500 trips versus just 2.9 or 2.4.
Okay, thank you, Joe.
And then we got the same for Peeler. A million pounds of Peeler harvest reported, you know, we always talk about that, has been kind of steady on for the past couple of years. We've gotten back up at least to a million pounds. So that's a total of, that puts us over 27 million pounds harvested total for blue crabs in Virginia last year. Like I said, that may go up a bit. And I'm going to put that in, there's a table that puts that into context with going back quite a few years. But you can see we've got pretty much all the reporting in there since there's not as much activity in the later months. So I think I don't expect that 1 million pounds to move very much. I don't know if you guys have any questions there otherwise. And there's total harvest. Dockside value looks good for 2016. Of course, you know, we've stood up here several times saying we don't have the greatest information on to tell you what the average price per bushel is. And you know it changes so much, so we don't get information quick enough to give you what would probably be a very meaningful average monthly or even a good annual weighted average. We just kind of, we send out price surveys to buyers. Those that are willing to respond, but they were paying for that time period. I would like to hear what you guys say as far as, did it seem like dockside value was better in 2016 than other years? Or, you know, same as recent years? And
worse.
Was it?
Down my way, anyway.
Because if you look at, we were getting closer to, like I said, 2010-11, which were pretty good years. You know, the dockside value, which is adjusted here for inflation.
Is the entire string of data modified for inflation? Everything's modified for inflation at 2016 dollars or 2015 dollars. Is that how that works? Okay. So something was good somewhere in 2016, it looks like. You know, it is the highest. I mean, again, you have to take the economic data with a little bit of grain of salt because we just don't get enough. I mean, that's
right.
That's
and what so if you, and the problem with it is if somebody reported when it was selling high and it dropped fast, we didn't catch that, and we just pretend that the whole month or that whole quarter, if you will, was high, then it looks, you know, it's way off.
As far as
I'm never really comfortable showing dockside value just because of that.
You have a percentage of buyers that actually do return of the survey to you or anything like that?
I mean, haven't updated that recently.
Is it like 50%?
No.
Nowhere near that?
No.
Okay.
I mean, it's usually just the same folks that consistently participate, and they're not necessarily high volume even. You know,
well,
it's just
so it's a very small percentage then.
I've looked down to my left three times now. Now I can say there's no one else down there besides
sorry,
you, so I can stop that.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Question in the audience.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
The 27 million pounds obviously is a combination of the hard and the peeler together. And so because that's 5 million pounds more than 2015, it really isn't unreasonable for that number to be 37 million versus 30 million.
Yeah, right. It's not that far off from the
It's about the same.
Yeah.
And when you do the value, the peelers skew the data, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's why a lot of times when we show it to the commission, we have to separate the two out. And you know, so that's when we do the tables, we always pull.
Have you seen variation between the value of the peeler crab versus the value of the hard crab.
I think we have a tough time getting value data, period. We always have. It's not mandatory, and I think that's why. So the best statistic we have is the harvest of all the statistics. And we don't claim we have 100% conformity to even that, but we know that we can look at the data and, you know, we can tell the trend of it. So this is a good trend harvest-wise.
Is there, perhaps you might know the answer to this question, is there a tremendous variation between the reports from the people who voluntarily, I know it's not many, but reports from the people who voluntarily report the value in one area versus another area?
I don't think we'd have enough of a sample to tell you that.
I think it usually boils down to more the time when we're asking than the time when they respond.
So it's the month. Mm-hmm. Not so much where they're being sold.
Yeah.
They're not, for example, more expensive the further north you go and less expensive the further south you go.
No.
Go back to that last slide you had there. If we look at May, you know, that's obviously a very busy time. And that's where I think if you compared prices, you'd find similarities. The rest of the year is a little more uncertain. So that's probably the best we can do.
Thank you.
Okay.
Robert, on the other slide you had.
Here?
Mm-hmm. I see you got all of that, but how about the amount of people doing it?
Right. Yeah.
How does that vary weight? I mean, how many crab was it in 1997 to 2016?
We can tell you.
Yeah.
We've looked at that before, but we can tell you.
Yeah.
I mean, has that gone up or down? Or?
Yeah, it's gone down. I mean, since 2009 removed a chunk of harvesters. Of course, part of that was there was a good deal of inactive in there. But even the active has come down. But like Rob said, there's a considerable amount of consistency even going back past the buyback.
So. Yeah. Okay, we'll look that up for you.
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, if I just played around here, I could pull up one of the older ones, but I wouldn't remember which one, so I'd be digging for a little bit. We can do it next. Yeah. So like we said, we don't, you know, we plotted this out, but it's got to take it with a couple grains of salt. And then moving into we'll see if there's any other questions because I'm grabbing the agenda.
I think we're good.
Okay. So the next item is possible management responses once we have the results from the winter dredge survey. So, Rob, I don't know if you have anything else.
Yeah, so the idea here is, and we went through this last year, it's unfortunate, but that we all wait for the results of the winter dredge survey, which are sometime probably in later part of April, and then we try and have the committee here pretty close to the time that those results are announced. There's just been no getting away from that, and it's so year by year we wait, and so Joe and I worked on a couple of approaches to look at ways that you could give advice. So in other words, you may recall in 2014, it was a depleted stock. It fell below the range of what it should fall below, and the stock was depleted. So climbing back up, thank goodness that blue crab is prolific, certainly climb back up. And last year was a pretty good year as far as the abundance of both all total crabs, juvenile crabs, and a little bit, if you look at the top row, even on the spawning crabs. They certainly weren't as good as the juvenile crabs at 101 million, but the juvenile crabs were 269 million. So there's two things to look at here. If you want to give advice to the commission, which is what this committee does, you want to know something about how things have gone in the past. You want to know, well, when has a good abundance or a pretty solid abundance of total crabs or juvenile crabs or all juvenile and spawning age female crabs, when has that occurred and what has happened? Well, what you see with this one is this is greater than 450 million crabs. And you see the end survey 2016, so that was last year, last April, a very solid number of spawning age female crabs. I think it was the fourth highest number of juvenile crabs. It may have been. Was it, Joe? Maybe not. Maybe not. It doesn't look that way. But so the commission will look at this type of information and judge it relative to the other years. But the thing that you should stand out is look at the commercial harvest baywide. We don't have 2016 yet, but we certainly have years where the total abundance was greater than 450 million and pretty successful harvests in the bay. That's all the jurisdictions together.
And it's true, too, for us. So the table I showed earlier only went back to 94, but so really the highest abundance years, all the early years of the survey were high. And then, you know, they started coming down around 97, 98. But you see 96, 94, 95, 96, 97, and here, 2010 and 11 in here. As we all know, 2012, that total abundance was high because the juveniles were high. The juveniles never showed up into the fishery. But other than that, all the years that are high on here are those years we were at or pushing 30 million pounds of harvest in Virginia, you know, including this last year where we're going to be somewhere over 27 million. So
I think what we can do next time, this is important. It gives you an idea of where is there a successful harvest based on a total abundance of crabs, juvenile crabs, which come into the fishery fully by August. I mean, they're in the fishery. And the adult female, or the spawning age female they actually are, you know, how do they stand as far as abundance as well? The problem is it's mostly baywide when you think about it, but you know we have a high female composition in Virginia, somewhere between the mid-60s to the low 70% of the crabs. But next time we'll put 2012, 13, 14, 15, and 16 together, and by April, late April, be able to put 17, because I know the commission's going to be interested and have in the back of their minds, now that they've been presented this data a few years, they're going to be thinking, well, it was depleted in 2014. How's it gone since then? How cautious do we need to be? How can we relax regulations? Can we relax regulations? And those are the things that I hope you'll think about when we get everyone together and, you know, you make a recommendation to the commission. You had another slide like this, didn't you, or was that the earlier one?
It was the kind of the next tier down, so between, you know, from 300 million to 450 million.
And you see right away that there's something to be said about the abundance because it didn't support the kind of harvest that your next slide supports.
Right. All of these years are.
So in 2005, and Joe mentioned CBSAC, Chesapeake Bay Stock Assessment Committee, they met and they came up with the idea that there could be 200 million male and female crabs as an interim target. And that would support roughly 60 to 65 million pounds of harvest, but it would also produce good recruits, good juveniles for the next year. And since we're in this management framework where it'll be July before the new regulations take place, and we'll meet with the commission in May, since we're in that type of framework, the juveniles are being looked at a little more critically than they were in the past, because they're your late summer, fall fishery mainly. I mean, they're still spawning age females around, but we've hoped they've spawned by then. They had the chance to do it in late May, and they had the chance to do it in July, August. So there's a lot you can do here to, you know, really pick apart this information, and you're not always successful even when you pick it apart, because you know, there's a lot of variability. You know, I think everyone here understands that the variability is getting these megalopy larvae invected back in the bay and starting the circuit all over again. So we'll work on that a little bit too with the recent years so they can see it next time.
Yeah, and there's just the targets from the newer targets that have been adopted. And okay.
Go back to that last one. There you go. Thanks, Joe. So everyone involved was working on the assessment, and those even who did the assessment back in 2011 are a little wary of the exploitation rate or the removal rate. And the reason is that includes all female crabs from juveniles up through the adults. That's all female crabs. And the situation is when that assessment was done in 2011 through 2009 data year, it was based on the winter crab dredge survey can only get to certain shallow depths, you know, 9 feet, 10 feet. I've heard different variations. And the juveniles don't really care 1 year to the next. They're going to be in a depth that suits them based on whatever the temperature and salinity, mainly the temperature, is. So there's this application of a correction factor that started in 2011 that persists. And it always assumes that you only get 40% of the juveniles with the winter dredge survey. And I think it doesn't make sense, because things change year to year. So one of the things that's going to be tackled is how to address that a little bit. Dr. Lipschitz from VIMS used to do some suction samples in real shallow water, but that was only done for a certain amount of years. So it's a little bit of a puzzle, but the reason that you should know all this is the abundance is going to be stressed more than anything else. You know, we're already almost 8 years removed from the assessment, and, you know, everyone who's involved thinks that that needs to be looked at pretty carefully, and something better has to occur. The one better thing is when you're done with blue crab, you have an absolute abundance, so that this is an absolute abundance estimate that comes out of that winter dredge survey. And one of the thoughts is to make it a relative abundance estimate, and that'll help with this exploitation rate. So this is just in case you hear that again next time we meet, but you know, we'll go from there. So you had one other slide?
I have a question about this.
Yeah.
Can I have a question about this?
Oh, hello there.
Earlier you stated that the last data on the last assessment maybe was 2009.
Right. Tell her, Joe.
Well, it's just the amount of time it takes to put all the data together. You have to stop at some point. Then you actually are working on the model. The model has to be peer-reviewed. And then when they publish a report, you know, you'll call whatever date that report was published, if it was March of 2011, because they spent all of 2010 working on the data. Because, you know, we're standing here in March of 17, saying we don't have all of, so they might have to wait until like the middle of 2010 to get all of the 2009 data. So by the time they finish it.
So shouldn't it say, though, I'm just asking, shouldn't it say, though, the 2009 stock assessment information reported in 2011? Because it's sort of misleading that you actually had an assessment in 2011 and you didn't.
No, we did. We did. There was an assessment in 2011. There was a peer review, which means experts from three different countries met in Maryland somewhere, and they went through the assessment. I think what you want to say is 2011 stock assessment through 2009 data year or something like that. That would capture what you want. But, yeah, it was actually completed in 2011. I was at the peer review. I confess I understood a lot of it, but some of it is the model stuff. is off the charts sometimes.
The last slide of that is just, you had mentioned putting the most recent years together.
Oh, you did? Okay, good. So you see the what they call the threshold or the danger zone is 70 million female spawning age crabs, the third column over, and it was actually 68.5 million, rounded up to 69. So everyone, if you remember, got very concerned. And what we tried to do, even though it's not a direct relationship, we tried to, in the jurisdictions, the agreement was, we'll cut back on harvest by 10%. And by doing that, that's what created the different seasons that we had for a few years. And it's probably something that, when we had the full committee, we can talk about, because there's still this idea that, you know, we went to December 20th, in 2016, in 2013 and 2012, we went to December 15th. Every other year, we went to December, you know, right to November 30th. So all those play into what type of a season should you have as well. And then what type of a season should the, what I won't call minor gear types, but the peeler pot, the crab trap, the crab scrape, what should those gear types have for a season as well? Because if you remember, we had to modify the seasons twice in the past to accommodate this 10% reduction. And what we learned pretty quickly when we did that was modifying in one area by a certain date had a bigger impact, for example, on the Western Shore. We were at May 1 when we started the first year in 2014, I think it was, or 2015. May 1 is when we started the peeler season, the fishery, and we closed it in October on the shore. And so right away we had some pretty unhappy phone calls saying, you know, you're affecting us on the Western Shore more than you're affecting the Eastern Shore. But then the Eastern Shore people called and said, well, wait a minute, we do really well. They use those habitat pots. We do really well right to the end of October. So we made some adjustments, and we'll probably be counting on you to figure out how we make that adjustment there. We had that situation last year where the traps were set a little early, and all of a sudden everyone was surprised because that season hadn't started yet. So we still have to talk about that. Not today, but just so you know it. I mean, I want to have at least a quorum when we start talking about that.
I think that's where those tracking this kind of information helps now too, because when you see number of harvesters participating in the harvest numbers, but also the number that are inactive in those time periods, it kind of gives you an idea of how much it means to people.
And we will send the committee what we have tonight. Once we get a few more information on the harvest update, that we'll send you, because it's really important for the next time we meet, for you to be able to go through the sort of what happens if it's a good year on the winter dredge survey, what kind of things should we promote, and if it's a bad year, what should we end up, you know, doing then? You know, what's our recommendation? So we'll send that information to you. And so far we have two requests, the inactive to active gear types, and what did it look like for number of harvesters from 1997 to the present. So we'll also include those. So I think we've covered the new business, and on your agenda there's some old business. The first one is continued discussion on the sanctuary areas. If I can remember the date for that, but I think we put those into effect starting 2016 season, if I remember. And we changed the northern area to June 1. Oh, it's up there now. Okay, June 1. And in the middle, we kept the season that had been there since 2009. That's when that May 16 to September 15th season was set. And in the lower area, the 1942 sanctuary area, that was lowered to May 9th. It had been May 16th. It was pushed back to May the 9th to September 15th. And Dr. Lipschitz did some equivalency runs, and I think what he said exactly was that this is equivalent. It's not only conservation neutral, it might be slightly conservation positive. I mean, those were the definitions that he gave us anyway.
Yes, and then we don't, you know, there isn't really a lot of new information as far as that type of analysis on what changes would mean, because we haven't had a lot of feedback on what kind of changes folks are looking for, other than, you know, some comments on going back closer to a consistent start date.
Mr. Gregory, you want to say something before?
We crab down there in the lower bay. It might not affect a lot of people, but we're the only place in the Chesapeake Bay along the Virginia Beach coastline right there from, I guess, where Little Creek would start would be the boundary line all the way around Cape Henry, all the way down there to the North Carolina line. Once it closes May 9th, we're all crammed inside of a little estuary in there called Leadhead. You know, there's about 12 to 15 crowded. It gets kind of crowded in there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if y'all give us a little bit longer in the spring where we can work out there and we don't get crammed on top of each other in the river and we have the conflict with all the recreational boaters, we've already got some conflict in there with the homeowners, other cases and all. Why can't we get a little bit more time in the spring and give up some time in the fall?
I think it has to do with the spawning activity, which is always the situation that you have there. So you've got crabs ready to spawn towards the end of May, is what we hear from both ODU and VIMS, that's the key time. So they're there to spawn. The proposal before was to get out along the coast a little bit and have that area where there used to be several crabbers, not a whole lot, but at least to have that area in that green band over there. And then where we left off in the discussion was, well, how far down would you be able to go before you run into conflict with those off Virginia Beach? I think that was the way we left that off. You know, you're at May 9th. All I know is it was done as a situation where it was looked at all three areas. And the June 1 is definitely based on temperature situation and also what crabs are there at that time. But the whole sanctuary is loaded with female crabs. It just depends on what month you want to pick and where they are. But I think the answer is back to spawning time, you know, that spring spawning. So if you go later, the fall is not going to be as important in that area because you've already had, we hope, two spawns, the spring spawn and the summer spawn. But, you know, we keep talking about it. There's no reason not to keep talking about it, but it's a little different than what was proposed back in 2015 as far as that extension goes along the coastal area.
Well, as far as the coastal, if we've got a meeting and agreement on the bay, why is the ocean closed?
The ocean was closed back in 2007. Is the way that happened as a conservation equivalency, which just means at that time there was something given up on the sponge crabs. That's when the sponge crabs changed over, and the sponge crabs went to July 1, I think, at that time, from July 16th, when you could keep dark-colored sponges. So what I recall is that was to mitigate that or help that situation. Whether it has any bearing today, that's a question we hear all the time, because when we have a full committee, I think every committee meeting, there are those who raise questions about the sponge crab and is it worthwhile to even have that as a regulation, And what we do know is that in June, temperatures at least are still, you know, okay for throwing back sponge crabs. Whereas if you get in July, you start to get too hot, it probably does not make much sense. And that's the way it was finally done starting back in 2007. And I think that's what the trade-off was with that green band there. So, but doesn't mean the committee can't talk about that. You can probably tell there's more in the audience tonight than there is up here. So because of that, you know, we hope to have a full committee in March, and that can be one of the things that's raised. I'm sure there'll be others raised as well. Is that okay?
Yeah, I was just, you know, we'd like to have something.
Sure.
Down there.
Sure.
Come May 9th, we're all crammed on top of each other in the river. I got a 500-foot license. It's not doing me no good, but 1 or 2 months out of the year, because I can't have the 255-foot crammed that little estuary,
yeah.
And the rest of them are crammed in my backyard catching birds.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good to hear from you, because I've never heard from you before on the subject, so that's good to hear from you. So come back in March when we meet again is what I'm saying, okay? All right, sounds good. Yes, yes.
I've got a real problem with the sanctuary in the Lower Bay. I mean, we're making up for other areas that are affected. We gave up to May 9th for the Upper Bay. You know, I don't want to, this is like you're almost putting one group against the other, and I don't want this to say that we're against the Upper Bay, but we're losing a lot. We're losing a lot of our income. I mean, we really are. I mean, it's bad. I mean, it really is. We've got local buyers that depend on our crabs, our female crabs that we catch. We get very good money. Come the 9th, they're done. They can't get their crabs. They have to go somewhere else to get them. So you've got a lot of the economy that depends on us that are basically out of crabs. They go right to Carolina and they get that crab. That's what they do. You know, I think I don't have a problem giving up more time in the fall of the year so I can crab till June 1st in that sanctuary. The sanctuary goes right to the shoreline, just like Mr. Gregory said. Nowhere other sanctuaries in the bay are affected the way that we are. I mean, that's the reality of it. You know, I'd like to see a graph to show basically the concentration of crabs in the bay. I know they have a chart. And you know, I've seen it. And I'm going to just say this. I've sat in this room year after year, and I've seen the charts and graphs. And I believe the largest concentration of crabs in the Lower Bay was a chart presented by Rom Lipskis. This goes back, and my memory could have failed me, but it said June is about the time that they show up down there. I don't know if it's still accurate data, but why are you putting us back till May 9th? I've got a problem. We don't have any place to go. And the other question is...
Well, let me answer that one. So May 9th came out of...
What we did in
2015. I don't know what it is, but May 16th was established because of the fact that the first time that everyone was aware from John McConaughey of ODU and Rom Lipschitz that the timing, the staging for the spring spawn was so important.
Right.
That's what generated May 16th. But I do have to say, we don't have the full committee here.
Yeah.
It's okay to say what you're saying, but two things. One, we know where crabs are abundant in March and not available to everyone.
Right.
And we know where crabs are available in early December and not available to everyone. So right. I think you have to keep everything, I mean, I'm just...
In perspective.
Yeah, I think you have to keep everything in perspective. But the other part is that we have looked, I don't think we're finished yet, but Megan has looked at, you know, what happens to crabbers? You know, why don't they move? So in other words, we hear a lot that, you know, the Tangier, some of the Bayside Eastern Shore, they'll go further down to Cape Charles. So we know they work out of Cape Charles. I think everyone realizes that. A lot of boats go down to Cape Charles. But other than that, it doesn't look, from at least preliminary work that Megan's done, that you get a lot of movement of the fleets. So it's very important to hear about Lynn Haven It's important to hear about Tangier. It's important to hear about those off the York River. I mean, that it's definitely give and take all the way around. And that's the kind of conversation that, you know, the committee should have about who's giving up what and who's losing what. So I can tell you that it may be palatable to recommend to the commission if earlier we talked about the abundance information. Mm-hmm. If we get a good abundance, it may be palatable for the commission to think about putting May 16th back in the lower area.
Right.
But, you know, it'd be really tough for me to tell them to put it to June 1st.
Well, I would rather see the whole thing June 1st, yeah. In my opinion, yeah. Everything. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think what we're doing really is we're causing a problem. We're causing a big problem by doing what we're doing by the earlier date. We're concentrating these people in small, small areas. And it's I mean, there's a lot of gear loss because of that. Yeah. You know, we're all forced in a tight hole. I mean, I don't know if you've been to the concrete ships on the Eastern Shore in summertime. Yeah. You can walk on those buoys, you know?
They'd like them not to be there, I think, too, probably.
Absolutely. Yeah, we don't want to be all jammed up on each other. Crab pots right now are $27. Mm-hmm. You know, who wants to cut off? Well, actually, that's just a pot. Rigged is $50.
Yeah.
We don't want to cut them off, but it's happening because we're so tight. I mean, the pot buoys are touching. I mean, like this, your microphones. That's what it looks like.
Yeah.
We need to do something about that. And as far as giving up, I don't mind giving up anything. You know, we've given and given and given, and you're making it to where you can't even make a living.
I'm not saying you.
I'm just saying in general because of our management practices.
2008 started a little revolution.
Which was a 34% reduction. I was all for that.
2008 is when everything started to change.
Right.
This is one of the outcroppings of what happened in 2008.
Right. It is.
So, but yeah, I'll admit, June 1st was there for many years, but the sanctuary wasn't. So most of that sanctuary was done in 2000 and 2002. You know, the 1942 sanctuary, everyone can guess that's been around a long time.
Right.
That was June 1 in the past. 2008 changed that.
I'm not saying open it, up 100%, but I think that we need to do something in the lower bay. Give us a small portion somewhere that we can go.
Yeah.
And you know as well as I do, historically there's been a very, very low number of crabbers in Area 3 and Area 4, which I'm totally confused about all these numbers. I'd like to see 1, 2, I'm confused.
Tell me your request because we can get that from Ron Lipschitz on the abundance data.
Well, I'd like to see a graph showing where the crabs are in the bay at certain months.
There was a paper put out by Stockhausen
in 2005
and Lipschitz
in 2005,
2002.
But there was also another paper in 2006 that also talked about tagging and sanctuaries, et cetera, et cetera.
So Megan can get in touch with Ron Lipschitz and ask for that information.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know.
Is that all right?
Yeah, that'll be fine.
Okay.
And then I have another question about the number 2 area. It was brought to my attention last year. I didn't even know this. Evidently, the western line on Sanctuary 2 has actually been redrawn somehow. Instead of going from, it used to be called some motel or something like that, but I guess the point is it used to run from the shoreline at Ocean View. It was the Harrison's Motel, the Nansman Hotel. It went in a straight line offshore to the Thimble, okay? Thimble Shoal Light, and then over to Cape Charles Light, and then back down to Cape Henry Light, and, you know, it followed the shoreline. It's come to my attention that basically what has happened, it's hard to see, but a little triangle area was added on that line and closed off somehow where it actually goes to the roadbed of the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel. And then it goes over to the Thimble. You can crab within 200 yards of the beach, but you can't crab any further out.
Okay.
How was that changed? That's code.
In the code of Virginia, it goes from the pier there
right.
to Thimble Shoals.
Then why are the officers enforcing 200 yards off the beach then? Is that a code or is that a regulation that y'all added? I mean, you can see it on the map there. It's a little yellow. I mean, it's a little
tiny. Still
in, maybe it's part of...
it's still in code. What's not in code is the season, because the season was changed by the General Assembly that gave the commission the flexibility.
Okay, well, the description, I don't know. You can't pull that up, can you, of the actual...
We could read it to you. We've got a code book right inside that library there if you want to...
Well, then maybe it's not part of the... sanctuary.
I think what he's saying is there a difference between the Code of Virginia Code and our reg?
Yeah.
Well, it isn't.
Because, I mean, it changes. It's somehow, there's a little tiny area, a strip there that was added somehow. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it has to do with 1B overlaps that somehow.
Well, Megan's almost going to find something. There she goes. She found it.
Because one of the crabbers that crab in that area and said he was actually approached by an officer and said if he goes beyond 200 yards or to the tip of the pier,
28-2709, I think, 709.
There were discussions on whether or not there was overlap with 1B in that corner.
Yeah, and
okay. Thank you, Megan.
Yeah, see, beginning at the point of origin of the center line of the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel facility is added.
Okay.
So I've got an old code book, which is like...
I've got some, too. I'll look, because this says the 2011 amendments. The only thing was to substitute Ocean View Fishing Pier for Harrison's Fishing Pier.
Okay.
So nothing was done other than that in 2011, and then you have to go back to 2009 probably. I can research that.
Yeah.
That's good. We can look at that.
16. Yeah, this is, so they've added that.
Okay.
Somehow.
All right.
And
that's important.
So, I mean, so that is added. I mean, it goes to the center line of the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel. So that's even more area that's cut out.
If it was changed, it went through a bill and it went through the...
And y'all, did y'all...
General Assembly, no.
Did y'all introduce it? Well, introduced as far as like dates?
I remember that we introduced the SWAT for the Harrison's Pier and then also the date.
Right.
And so
somehow that got changed.
Yeah. Okay, we can look at that.
So what do you do about something like that? I'm just kind of curious.
We'll have to see if it's there.
I mean,
yeah.
According to that, we're even giving up even more.
Yeah, we'll have
you
to
know,
see.
And the crabber, I don't know if he got a ticket or not. I don't know if he got a ticket. He may have been warned.
It's obvious it has to be fixed by the General Assembly if it's what
right.
You think it is.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, well, it's obvious it is.
So let's look first, and then we'll tell you. So. All right, any other mysteries? Because this is a mystery.
You're putting I didn't even know anything about it. I try to keep up on things like this.
All right. We've got four things to do already. If we keep at this, we're going to be here a while. So,
I don't even.
That's what we're here for. All right, Joe, what do you have there? Anything else?
The next item.
Okay, agents. Something we've talked about so much that it's hard to recall why it became a big issue, but I think we did. 2 years ago, we had like 156 agents, and then last year we noticed that it went down to 125. And if it's above 125, it means someone wrote to the commissioner and said, I've got some medical situation, I need help with this, I need help with that, because the commissioner has the authority to do that. Looks like we ended up with 110 out of the 125. I have to confess, when we first went down to the 168, so I thought we had 156 plus more, but okay, 168. When we first went to this, it was if you had a 2012 license or you had transferred your 2012 license to someone else, those were the crabbers that were eligible to have an agent. And the very first year after that, 2013, I noticed that only some of the 2012 licensees came forward. And 2014 and on, each year it's been probably more new requests for agents than 2012 licensees or licensees that transferred their license. This boils the blood of some people just because they feel that, you know, I'm a crabber and I really don't want to see an agent out there because that means that whoever has the agent is also doing something else, maybe making another income, obviously doing something else. In some cases, agents are in the peeler fishery to help with the traps, and you might have several doing that. I don't know. I mean, we're going to need the full committee to address this, but if you have any thoughts on the way things stand right now with 125, you know, feel free to comment on that. Okay?
I'm against agents. I'll tell you that point blank. You know, it should get back to the way it was set up for. You know, if you had a, you know, some kind of hardship medical, that's my opinion. And I'd like to do away with it.
And you know, we've been doing this so long.
As simple as it is. I mean,
you get another picture painted by someone like Ty, who said on several occasions,
right,
he gets one and doesn't necessarily use it. So that's how you get more asked for than used. There's not even necessarily
an
intent. But his big concern is you know, he couldn't even go away on vacation and if he needed that income.
Yeah.
But, you know,
I think it's a bigger problem than, like, where I live. Yeah. You know, not where I live, where I work. I think, like, in the city area, you know, in the Lower Bay, you know, we've got people, you know, that have other jobs, they have a license, and you know, personally, I like to see it, you know, where you don't have you can't use agents and tributaries and just have at it in the bay. You know, that's, I mean, but okay. Really, you know, so.
Wayne or?
Well,
first?
This past weekend, mm-hmm. I say do away with it all. Let it go back to the way it used to be. Saturday, I had something that I had to go do. Then I got 20-some-year-old boys that could have went out and fished my nets for me. I couldn't let them do that because I have to make them an agent.
Not for nets.
Yes, switch all these rockfish tags over.
Now that's a different different category.
While I could go, you know, make this run I had to make, and therefore they couldn't do it.
Well, I mean, I got nets out now. I got a dogfish permit I can't transfer or have an agent for.
I mean,
it's the same thing.
My permission to go fish these nets, they have the tags in the boat. Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't it be okay for them to go do that?
Only because since it started with the ITQ in 1998, it's always been the permittee has to be on board the vessel. But you're going to have to come to our FinFish Management Advisory Committee to work on that.
It's still the same thing as making them an agent.
Yeah.
If I was to make them an agent for to do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, it's
certain things you can't have an agent. Oysters, rockfish. There are certain fisheries you just can't.
Corn pot.
That's the way it's been. Yep. So, but I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
But clearly that's something for.
But it's the same way with the crabs.
Yeah.
Suppose I can't go fish the peeler traps one day.
Yeah.
They can't legally go do it.
Mm-mm.
And you know, if you leave the peelers in the traps, they're going just going to be wasteful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this is sort of a contentious issue, but less contentious than it was, but it still rankles some people. I understand that. I think in the old days, when we started everything out in 1993, the idea was that, as Mark said, you had a medical problem or you had military service. And I think a lot of people think that it may be a better system if the word gets to the commissioner and he can authorize someone to take care of a problem like yours, because that's humane. You know, that's what you would hope someone would do. But then we don't know how many problems there'd be like that. And that's why there's, that's why it's the way it is.
So you're saying there could be something done?
There can always be something done, but you have to look at the impacts and you have to look at the practicality of it. Because you could probably see, just like your, let's just say you're having to need someone to go out and fish your nets. All right, you try and get word to the commissioner, he's not here. You try and go down the chain, they're not there, they're in North Carolina, like I was last week. You know, it's just not practical.
You know, and just like that, they'd all come about Friday evening.
Yeah.
You know, for Saturday.
I mean, the rockfish fishery is held pretty tight for a reason. It's not that there aren't problems.
But I've been in the same situation with the field traps before, too.
Is there any way you can reduce the gap, like every 5 years?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
That way we'll give people...
That's a good idea.
Knowing they're going eventually going to lose it.
That's a good idea. That's exactly what they did with our shad fishery. ASMSC gave us 5 years. They said, in 5 years, you're out. And everyone enjoyed it as long as they could, and then that was it for the ocean fishery, the shad ocean fishery. So that's a good, I like that suggestion because it gives people time. I don't know whether 5 years is necessary, but, you know, that's up to the committee.
If you get it down to 50 people.
Yeah.
We've been going that direction.
I mean, some people.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, we've been going
that
direction.
I can see a problem where you might name one.
I mean, because there are people who are doing this more or less for health issues, but it's a chronic thing.
And I think the commissioner should have the say or somebody on them 50.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I think that's worthy of bringing up next time we meet. That's a good one. So that just tells us who's in which category there, right?
This is the waiting list now. We're on next agenda item.
That's where we started out in 2009.
Yep.
847.
What is the 211?
That's the pot category.
Those are the if you buy the gear. And that's the gear license.
Yeah, that's right,
yeah.
Is that how many people have it?
No. To the right is how many people have it.
Okay.
That's how many people were on the waiting list in 2009. So 201 had the up to 85 pot license or eligibility for the license. And only 14 were in the up to what's now 455. 425. Did I say 455? 425.
Yeah. These are in the license category order, not the number of pot
orders.
Okay.
What is the...
Yes. I do see what you mean.
What is the 32, like on the 425 license mean?
That there were only 32 people put on the waiting list for what used to be the 500 pot license.
Oh, so in other words, you got 600 people that's on the waiting list.
Because the people that got bumped onto the waiting list were folks that didn't have any activity from 2004 to 2007. And, you know, that 500 category was a lot more active, so there were only, out of all of those license holders, there were only 32 that were put on and stayed on, basically.
515, not 600. 515 total.
So now we turn to today.
There's only 126 on the hard pot waiting list. So, some folks that wanted to be back in did buy someone else's license to get back in. There was an exception process an extensive one that went on each and every commission meeting in 2009 through June. The folks came in explaining why they weren't able to harvest from 2004 to 2007, and there were exceptions granted to remove some of those. But the vast majority of vast majority of the people that are no longer on the waiting list are no longer there because they don't have a commercial card. If you don't have a commercial card, you know, you're no longer eligible for anything.
Most of probably some passed away, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. The vast majority were actually deaths.
Well, yeah.
And that, the waiting list was no activity at all, crabbing, period. Not one crab was landed.
Did anybody get on the waiting list now?
No. That ended in 2008 when the commission put 857 on the waiting list. And a lot of those situations, they hadn't crabbed back to 2000 even. So a lot of those folks that are left, the 200 and some folks that are left, you know, they... Many of them haven't crabbed for the last 15 years. However, there are one or two who call us and wonder what their status is and when they're going to get off the waiting list. And the way you get off the waiting list, when you saw Joe put up the, you know, the target for the abundance, when there's 3 years of, you know, the abundance of spawning age females in a row, that's when you get off the waiting list. And the only time that's happened is 2010, 1 year so far. So for all practical purposes, that's a pretty tough thing to that they face.
Well, like 2010 that happened, would it, everybody get off the waiting list?
No, because no, you have to have 3 years in a row.
You've got to have 3 years of
so
it in a row.
So as soon as it didn't happen again in 2011, that clock started all over again. And they'd have to, you know, they'd have to get three in a row again. Mm-hmm.
People that are calling you, do you know, are they full-time working watermen or are they just crab, I mean, we're crabbers or just, do you know by any chance?
Yeah, well, I mean,
they got to be written once because they had the license for that.
Well, I mean, you can buy a card. That's not what I'm saying. Yeah, but
you couldn't buy a card. You had to have a crab pot license back when that came out in 2008.
What I'm saying is, are they working on the water right now?
Are they doing anything
job?
Else?
Usually they want to work on the water again, okay, is so what I hear.
So they're not necessarily working on the water.
Right.
Now, but then
and
they buy their car.
They took jobs
year.
And they want to get back on the water.
Okay.
So.
And some are family folks that, you know, they. I've had folks check in with me saying, you know, my dad lost this license. He's got no intent of going out again. But would it ever come back to the family?
Right. Hello.
Based on this data, approximately 55 people a year. Away from the waiting list, and if the trend continues in 2 years, there'll be nobody.
Right. It's
or a handful. Could be less than 20.
Yeah, it's come down a lot. Yes. You're right.
So
okay.
Whatever the intent was has come to pass.
Well, I think also when this happened, there were trying to think of how the licensing went, but there were those who probably today wouldn't be brought back in for bad data, you know, or data that was so far out of date. I mean, it still had to be looked at by staff and the forms checked and everything else like that. But today, if you said, I haven't turned in my data for the last 4 years, I don't think the commission would be so liberal.
Right. No.
So.
And you know, if you go back here, you know, Rob said, we'll get these people to report. So we've got 86 people that haven't turned in any kind of report for November. They can't pick up their commercial car until they turn in a report. And so they've got until the end of April to buy their commercial card, or they'll actually lose their commercial card. So they're very motivated to report harvest at the end of each year now. You know, we weren't doing that back then.
Yes, ma'am.
I say this every time, but I'm like Mark. Doesn't hurt to say it every time. When the Virginia Marine Resources Commission came to our family and said we would really like to reduce the number of people and we're going to do this buyback program when the funds were available, and people who were enticed to do other fisheries by the way of grants, that did not mean that they were not going to crab necessarily if they had crab pot license, it means that they may not crab as much when move in some other fisheries for a while and let the crab population come back. So we always have to remember that there are people who have been watermen for multi-generations, and they do multiple fisheries, and they're doing what they're asked to do.
Sure.
Now, that may not be these 55 people that are dropping out off the waiting list every year, like you say, through either death, or they don't have a commercial license anymore because they don't want to pay for one and they don't see any way to use it, or just got on the waiting list because they thought there was going to be another buyback program or something. You know, I've heard people say that. You know, I want to get a crab pot license if sometime down the road I'm going to get paid for it again.
Yeah.
You know, that was another thing that was a misconception on the part of some people on the water. I'm not saying anybody in particular. I'm just saying some people thought, well, there's going to be another buyback program at some point.
Right.
We don't know that. Could be. Could not be. But I don't see it happening in the current administration.
Well, I think what has happened is that the crab fishery used to be the refuge for a lot of the harvesters. In other words, they could always count on getting into the crab fishery when they were doing those other things and didn't want to do those other things, or the other things weren't panning out. And in 1999, that ended. So the moratorium on licenses stopped that. And I think that did impact sort of the heritage and what the harvesters would look forward to. And then the second part of that is, as you probably know, we developed these transfer systems, which I think the report card's out on whether they're really good or bad. In other words, they do give opportunities, but they give opportunities when it requires some type of payment, and not everyone can afford to pay. So, you know, the transfer system we deal with a lot here in many different fisheries, and that's what happens with limited entry. And the first thing I remember about limited entry is Dr. Kirkley from VIMS gave us a stack of literature back in 1992, I think it was, and he said, look through these. He said, I'll be surprised when you end whether you'll think limited entry is good or bad, because there's all sides of it. All sides of it. So yeah, looking back is kind of interesting. You're right. Joe, what'd Megan tell you?
Well, we kind of do have more. She was just pointing out that we did have a few other things that we didn't send out on the agenda because we had sorry. Let's just see it. Right. The Darryl
yes.
Possum.
Thank
so
you.
I'll turn it over to Megan.
Very good, Megan.
We'll be brief.
I'll be really brief. So as you might be aware, we have a kind of a derelict crab pot problem in the bay. So these are ghost pots. They fish after they've been lost. So as you might recall, we had that pot removal program from 2008 to 2012 that removed 32,000 derelict pots from the bay. And it's been estimated that about 10 to 30% of all crab pots are lost annually. And these pots can continue to fish for two or more years, catching a variety of commercially important species, you know, black sea bass, oyster toadfish, and threatened species like terrapins. And also, they continue to fish for blue crabs, estimated between, depending on where your study is, between 20 and 50 blue crabs per year per pot, harvested in derelict pots. So you are losing some of your harvestable animals. So one solution to this is a biodegradable panel. Now, this is only one solution, and we don't want to focus solely on this, but these are plastic biopanels, and they limit the loss, the impact of lost gear by basically degrading. They dissolve in the water, and they leave holes in the gear. So things that get in through the funnel can get out through these holes. And they haven't impacted catch in actively fished gear. So the figures on the right, actively fished gear, these biopanels stay relatively good looking, like they don't degrade over time. In non-fish gear, so gear that's left in the water continuously, the microbial enzymes will continuously degrade the panel until it dissolves. So the microbes die in sunlight. So in the water, they're fine, but once the pot gets pulled out of the water, those microbes die, and so they stop digesting the panel. So that's why actively fish gear, these panels are supposed to last an entire season. Now, there are other ways to do this. You can use wood panels. You can use any kind of natural fiber, like a jute or cotton string, and just, you know, cut a hole in your pot and wrap the string around. So this is just one thing we're interested in, and we are testing not these panels, but something that looks similar to them. I have like 8 or 9 crabbers who are testing them out for me. They're each putting them on 50 pots and fishing them this season. So hopefully we'll get some nice data from them.
How big a hole are you cutting?
These are about, I should have brought one. I did not.
The panel, I think I've seen.
The panel is about yay big.
Do you have a panel?
She's as big as a phone.
Yeah, the panel is about yay big.
Is it black in color?
It's black. Yeah.
Okay, I saw that panel. I mean, I know how big the panel is, but I got looking at it. I'm like, how big a hole do you cut?
This big.
You know? Do you cut like 6 marshes or something like that of the pot?
Mm-hmm. That's the intent. Yeah.
So what are we trying to exclude exactly?
The crabber.
No. It's if the pot is lost, it's supposed to make it ineffective for fishing.
Right.
Yeah, but the point of a pot is to be able to fish it. They structurally take half the side of the pot out and put these in.
Yeah.
I have some. I'm going to try a couple this year.
Okay.
But what I'm getting at is here I am going to cut a big hole in the side of a crab pot,
You
know, and I use 60-foot of line in the bay. That wraps around that pot. It's going to crack that. And then on top of that, it's going to weaken the pot. I mean, I'm not against a panel.
We actually had a crabber who had already started to use these. He tested the strength of his pots without any coal rings, with the normal coal rings, and with the black coal panel, the bio panels,
mm-hmm.
and found no difference in the weight that needed to crush the pot.
Well,
so
is
they
he
aren't impacting the strength of the
pot. Well, you know, I mean, each pots are built different. I mean, some pots I have are braced all the way around. Some pots are not braced at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And I can take a pot and make it look like an hourglass. I mean, seriously. And if that panel, you know, and then, you know, you're cutting 6 marshes out of that pot, that's a big hole, and which also weaken the pot.
How about turtles?
Turtles can, well, the smaller ones are the ones that are getting in your pot in the first place.
I ain't talking about them.
No, we're talking
I'm
sea
talking
turtles.
About the ones that will crush that panel.
Yeah, they'll take it with their
they
bill
take my rings, man,
it.
Crush them.
They twist it. Oh, yeah. I can bring you a crab pot that looks like a...
These are all things that we would like to hear, so...
You know.
Obviously, these are kind of expensive because they're new. They're about 50 of these.
Yeah.
Which is pretty expensive, and we think it would be expensive.
8 months. Yeah. Who, the black panel that you're pushing, I guess?
I don't want to say we're pushing it, but that's the one we could get. And
okay, who's got the patent on that? I'm just kind of curious. Do you know?
We got them from Mobjack Binnacle Products. Uh-huh. This panel, the white panel, is patented by Kirkhaven.
Who is?
James.
And
but the black panel...
can I ask you about it? Is he the guy that did the ghost pot?
Yes.
Yeah.
So he took our data that we supplied him with the ghost pot thing
mm-hmm.
with the funding... that he gave, you know, the hummingbird sonars and stuff like that, took that data, and now he's trying to formulate and get a patent for an object to put in a crab pot that will monetarily basically improve his income?
Like I said, the panels that we are testing are not those panels that are patented.
Well, it brings up a good subject for the committee, which is,
I mean,
I've been treated to 2 presentations of the... study in terms of not only the impact on resources, including crabs and others, but also the monetary savings. And I would like the committee to at least have the summary or the executive summary of what Andrew Scheld and mm-hmm. Kirk Havens and Donna Bilkovic mm-hmm. have worked up, because they ought to see that, because I'd like your comments on that, because, you know, my idea is they're talking about over $3 million saved each year. And I think what I keep seeing is the abundance of crabs is so variable year to year. You just saw it in your charts. You know, it's so variable that it's hard to say what the savings might be, but I think we can give that to the committee next time to have them just look at it. But on this, I would have liked to have seen, you know, it's tough to fish, obviously, 240 days a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get a few over 200, but if that had wrapped around to the next season, I'd like to see what that last slide would look like to compare it to just soaking for 240 days and not being fished. So, yeah.
Well,
Mr. Weibel? Right.
Why do we need a bay? And another thing, if it's spring crabs, they eat the vinyl out of my pot. That's biodegradable. How long do you think it's going to take them to eat that?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, that was going to be my other question. I mean, we don't have to use that panel.
No.
We could use some kind of biodegradable pig ring with a mesh wire or something like that.
I mean, there are a lot of alternatives.
Yeah.
And I think we are looking at, I'm giving those people a survey, the people who are volunteering for me, and asking them, you know, what other options.
Did you give them other options? Other than the panel?
We are actively testing this panel. So
but you have
not
other
testing
options.
Currently, and we're not testing other methods.
But you have other options you can dig up.
Yes.
There are
wood panels, like thin, almost like veneer.
Right.
Degrades. All of the other options seem very viable to me. I don't know why. They're way cheaper, too.
Yeah, that's what I don't understand.
They're more homemade. Because the idea of the wood panel is, I don't think there's one that's produced for blue crab. They do it in the stonecraft for sure. So, that would have to...
Could you find different examples of the different kind of... I'd like to see that, because I personally don't feel that this would work for me in general. I'm not saying it's a bad idea. I'm totally for savings, period. Any kind of savings that we can gain, I'm for that. I just don't see this working.
Right.
I think there's too many problems with
it's
the...
$3 a pot, too.
Yeah.
And
then also degrade the crab pot itself.
And we understand that, and so this is what we're testing currently. There are obviously, I would say, at least 10 other options to look into.
Yeah, could you dig those up
yes,
for me?
Totally.
Okay.
I mean, there's Mr.
Gregory?
That have biodegradable panels. Mm-hmm. Are these the same ones that other states use? Have you gone and researched those panels that they've used?
New Jersey does use a similar panel to this in... but it's a different size and shape. The guy who makes the ones we're testing makes the lobster ones too. So I can ask him if he actually sold it to anyone up there.
I just know down in the Gulf they have used a similar panel, and mm-hmm. I didn't know if these were the same ones that they used.
They might be.
The
person who makes them makes them for many states and many fisheries.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if they use them down there and it's proven. It might work up here, but the landing level is different down there,
mm-hmm.
and crabs are different too. So.
And they also have a longer season.
So just so you know, NOAA is moving on marine debris removal projects and all sorts of things involved with that. And, you know, this is really not original from us, because I think NOAA has a big push, you know, to try and work with that because of marine mammals, sea turtles, things like that. I think that's where that all starts. And I think about 5 years ago, maybe more, maybe 7 years ago, I had a request from Protected Species in NOAA. And, you know, they look at, you know, conch pot lines, and they look at crab pot lines. They look at everything. Then they ran out of money, is what I think happened. And then a few years later, they're back kind of asking the same information. But NOAA is definitely funding these type of projects. I just heard something last week where a fellow from Maryland, not Department of Natural Resources, but in Maryland, was looking at black sea bass pots and looking at ways that, you know, they could stop the loss of black sea bass pots. But if you saw what Megan had up there at one point, the number of pots lost each year in a 10 to 30% range. So, I mean, that gives you some perspective of where it might be. I mean, go ahead.
How, I'm just wondering how you would come up with that figure, 10 to 30% of crab pots lost.
That was a survey done probably by Kirk or Sheld.
Yeah.
I think by Andrew Sheld, he surveyed some more of them, asked how many crab pots.
I'm familiar with 10%.
I would say every crab would lose 10%.
Right. 10% sounds reasonable, but then you're talking 35,000.
If I lost 30% of my gear, I'd be out of business.
Yeah.
Yeah. When was that survey done?
This paper was 2016, so the survey was probably done the year prior.
And you don't have any other data that may go back to, say, early 2000 that would support any of this at all? Was there another study ever done about pot loss, or
there's probably one done for the pot removal program. Do you know if there was?
Say pot removal, was that the ghost pot?
Yeah.
Yes.
No, I'm talking pre.
Yeah. I'm saying that there might have been a kind of summary of any of that kind of data in that program. Do you know?
Not really. There was a write up. I think the main thing is in that paper that I'm talking about that. Yeah.
So his paper summarizes the results he got from his survey and also from other states, and they all had similar kind of loss statistics in the 10 to 20% range.
In the blue crab fishery that they have in their states.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they were within 10 to 30%.
Yeah, I would say 30 is a little high.
Yeah.
10 to 20.
Yeah, 30% is too high. Yeah, way too high.
Yeah.
And I guess the reason I'm asking this question about early is because do you think, and I'm going to go back to it, do you think we're having a greater loss of pots because we're pushed out of the main stem of the bay or jammed into smaller areas? And would
so you mean like?
Yeah, I'm going to go.
Loss
by
various
cut lines and
earthing. Yeah, basically what it comes down to, you're pushing us into smaller areas. So because of the smaller areas, do you think that is attributing to a greater loss of crab pots?
I mean, that I assume that you do have loss, and part of your loss probably is someone cutting your lines.
Right.
Do we know where the 32,000 derelict crab pots came from?
There are maps. They're all along the tributaries.
We could look at a map and see where they came from.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Map exists. I can do that.
We can show you that.
I'm just kind of curious, you know.
Well, I think the main thing is just to stay tuned because, you know, really NOAA's had several meetings. They're funding these projects. You know, I don't hear everything, but I can put two and two together there that, you know, they have some interests that relate back to fisheries and protected species.
Right.
I did these questions and answers for them this summer for NOAA, and they paid us $150 to go in. And that was one of the questions, is the main interaction with commercial gear and the recreational boater. And they wanted to know our opinion on it, on how we would have less gear loss. And everybody that was in the room come up with a lack of public knowledge towards the recreational sector on commercial gear. You know, just like driving a car, it's all on education. You know, the recreational sector doesn't have the knowledge about commercial buoys or the crab pot buoys, conch pot buoys, or gill net buoys of any, you know, when they get up to it in a boat or anything.
Right.
You know, we all went back to it should be part of the boater safety course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not as simple as knowing which side of the buoy you go on to kind of cut line off.
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to save our gear because of water costs, and we don't want to interact with the recreational sector.
Sure.
So we all come up and say it's short of black knowledge, black vision.
Clean, isn't it?
Believe it or not, the commission passed a regulation many years ago that keeps recreational fishermen from within, I think it's 100 feet of a pound net, because there were complaints about all the sinkers and the gear and the hooks and everything else. I don't think anyone's ever enforced it or ever had any problems with it, but at the time, the gentleman was quite upset that that was happening to him. So, you know, that's probably not the best way to educate recreational public, and you know, I'm sure there's some pretty good recreational public that are savvy, but there's a lot of people out there. That's the situation. So you wanted to put that on the boater safety course, some questions there? Is that what you said?
Well, no, they were trying to figure a way to better inform the recreational boater, you know, and we all come to the conclusion it's lack of knowledge.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
I mean, when we did the ghost spotting program, the hot spots were in front of the boat ramp and in front of the campground.
Okay.
On the eastern shore.
Plain and simple.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where I did it. Really.
Yeah. Huh.
Well, it's the same way. Even for us, when we did the coloring study, we went out of Wallace and we talked to the center. And we probably lost that, but if we found it, it had a lure in it.
Okay, well, Megan's going to have something else to tell you. Here we go.
So this isn't us, but this is a request from Hamish Small at VIMS. He recently got some funding to study disease in crab shedding operations. So he would like to, he gave me a couple slides, but I don't really. He's looking particularly at disease. Reovirus number one, and they're doing, this is a concurrent project in Maryland, Virginia, and Louisiana. And he would basically just like to do a roundtable discussion after our next CMAQ meeting, or it can be separate from CMAQ if there are interested parties. He just wants to talk to anyone with who is shedding, who thinks disease is an important, I guess, detractor from their business. You can also contact me, and I can basically get you in touch with him as well.
Any shedders out there? No?
No.
You do a little bit.
Is this a disease that's already in the crab when we catch it, or is it?
It's a disease that I think, yeah, it's there. It's present in hard and soft crabs, but there's something with being in the enclosed tanks for the shedding that kind of makes the crabs more susceptible to mortality from the disease. So if those crabs with the disease were in just the bay and shedding, yeah, some of them would die, but a lot of them would survive the disease. But being crowded or, you know, under less than optimal conditions in a shedding tank might lead them to die, like more of them to die. So just increase in mortality from disease.
Right. I shed and still do it the old way in the creek.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I pump it into the house, but the mortality rate has been great the last, you know, it's not very many that die the last 7-8 years. It's a lot of grass and come back, and they're living a lot better.
Yeah. So.
But these enclosed systems, you know, I know that
it's a lot of how you handle them, too.
Yeah, and it's a lot of the way you handle
them. The hardest message that we want to get out to all those who are in the peeler fishery is report the crabs that you harvest, not the crabs that make it, that shed out okay, but report all the crabs that you harvest. There's still this perception in this day and age that if you underreport, somehow you're doing a favor to yourself, and you're not, because you know, eventually what happens is the better numbers we have, the better we're able to look at, I'll say it again, limited entry, because we really don't have truly limited entry in blue crab. We have a moratorium on licenses, but back in 2009, when there were discussions flying around, one of the discussions was maybe we can develop a system where we have pot days. You know, to where a crabber, based on his history, can have a certain amount of pot days, and we can manage that effort that way. So, you know, really, it's always a good idea to report everything. This isn't a public service announcement. This is the truth. I mean, you should report everything you catch, because it'll bite you if you don't. And we're still trying to get that from a lot of the industry, and you know, we haven't done a whole lot is the problem. So we have geared up now for mandatory reporting, to where we'll have some pamphlets. Joe knows a little bit more about this than I do. I just had the idea that we needed to get out there, and we actually, one of our members wanted to have us visit their Watermen's Association. And turns out, by the time we got ready to say we're ready to come over and visit, nope, that's okay, don't worry about it. So, I mean, we're willing to even come to you and meet with you and help you figure out what's the easiest way that you can get your reporting done. Now, some of you are probably pretty good, computer savvy, all that. That's great. But there are a lot who aren't. And I think it's a long time from 1992 until the present to do a big outreach. We've done a few things. We've gone to the community colleges and done a few there, but the turnout wasn't as good. Mandatory reporting is for the benefit of the industry more than anything else. Hello, Mr. Weibel.
We should really look into kind of making the online reporting more simpler and flow easier.
Yeah, that's a project right now.
Online reporting, and it's pretty frustrating sometimes. You type stuff in, it disappears before you click on it.
Well, let's see what frustrates you. Rob said, started out the meeting that... When he did introductions, he said that we got three staff members, and one of them right now is pretty much working with speaking about making online reporting better.
Yeah.
If we know what to change,
the biggest problem is the stuff disappearing because you got to type in the fields and before you click on it, it's gone.
Are you using an iPad? Okay, because I have an iPad, you type along and then you look, there's nothing there.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah, I'll guess
it. Now it pops up before you click on it, it's gone, and then you got to delete it and type it in again.
Yeah, if you have problems, just call us and we'll work through them.
This saves up a big pitfall. Your report is ridiculous.
I got a wife. It's a good thing, too. I don't know what's going to happen when she goes.
Megan, you all set? Okay. All right, well, I'll tell you what. We'll see you again in March. I'm going to set the meeting right now for March the 27th. That's a Monday night. The next meeting? March 27th.
What time?
4 o'clock would be really good. I think the earlier time actually helps some in industry rather than 6 o'clock, doesn't it? Although you'll be hitting some crabs and by March 27th is a problem.
Yeah, that's not good for me, I mean.
All right, we're back to 6 o'clock. 6 o'clock. 6 o'clock on March 27th. And Megan's going to ask the committee, will you be able to attend? But I think we ought to stick with that schedule because that's, you know, we're going to be closer to, you know, getting the winter dredge survey results. We'll still have a month, but, you know, we'll have more of a conversation. And, you know, we'll hold these meetings. I mean, I do feel badly that it's been a while since we had a meeting, but it just tells you that we're sort of up against the wall most of the time. And, you know, but this is very important to us as a fisheries management division and to the commission. I mean, they definitely want to hear from you by the time we get to April. And then May will be the final public hearing. Okay, so thank you for all who came out. Anyone else have anything to add up here? Nope. All right. Okay. All right.
Sorry.
Okay, you're not. Okay. Thank you very much.
Did do you know, she sent an email. Did she get any kind of feedback from the other members? Or
she said seven people sent her something. It was in response to
eight
or something, I think.
She's going to get them, I think.
Yeah, this is not good, but, I mean, I do feel bad that so much time has gone by.
Because, I mean, I've lost.